It is good to be with everyone back again following the Feast of Tabernacles, and we're pleased to see that you're all part of a vibrant congregation, just a delight. And we're gathered here together on the weekly Sabbath in a convocation as God has expected of us since the creation of mankind. But now, since the days of the annual fall feast are completed, we begin a six-month period of time in which there are no feast days, no annual holy days prescribed by God. However, we will have a number of unholy days, some pagan holidays that we will encounter. Just a few that we that are coming up will be Halloween, which is almost upon us, and Christmas 2 months away, and then comes New Year's Day and Valentine's Day, and then following up with Mardi Gras and has its Fat Tuesday, and then a period of what they call Lent and Easter. And all of those things will occur during this six-month period. And I'm sure there's a few other pagan holidays in there that I might have just skipped over. And we'll be faced with a variety of challenges. And the challenges will be in our personal lives. It'll involve our work, our school, perhaps finances, family relationships, our health, our spiritual lives, and our general well-being. And from my experience, every year is different, except to realize that there will be challenges that we will that will come upon us. So what circumstances that we face individually might be quite different than what someone else might face? And yet there are some common approaches that we can use to successfully overcome any difficulties that may be in our future. The title of today's message is, Do We Have a Plan? Do we have a plan? Now, many years ago, at the beginning of a graduate school counseling course at the university, the professor put a statement up on the board. He wrote it up on the board, and he wrote these words, Where there is no counsel, the people fail, but in a multitude of counselors, there is safety. And then the professor asked if anyone knows where that statement came from. Well, I waited. I looked around the room. There were about 16 graduate students there, and most of them were destined to be professional counselors. And seeing that no one else raised his or her hand, I kind of just volunteered the answer. And I said, well, from the book of Proverbs in the Bible. Well, the professor seemed stunned for the moment, and I suppose he was surprised because had anybody answered at all, because the class was unusually quiet. And the professor then asked me, he said, well, when was that statement written? And I said, well, about 3,000 years ago. And the professor went on to emphasize his point that counselors have been around a long time and that counsel is an essential part of wellness. And that's in a counselor's job, is to help people enhance their sense of well-being, to live a better life. 100 years ago or so, Will Rogers, an Oklahoma Cherokee cowboy, was a humorist who explained three ways that people learn. Some people learn by reading. I like reading. Some people learn by observing others. I like to think I watch others. And then some people have to touch the electric fence for themselves. They've got to go through the experience. Well, I grew up as a farm boy, and I knew from an early age what it was like to touch an electric fence. Now, city folks might know this, but cattle, that some cattle are fence testers. There's a hot wire that runs around, or electric fence that runs around the field, but there's usually one in every herd that will come up every once in a while and put its nose on the hot wire for just to test it, to see if the wire is hot or not, meaning if electricity is going in. So it's an unusual cow, but there's always one somewhere, just like there's always one in the crowd that'll try something. And if the electric fencer is not working, that cow will be the first one to push over the fence to eat the grass on the other side, maybe knock down the wire, and then all the cows are going to get up. And now you got to panic. Every livestock farmer knows what it's like when the cows are out. It usually happens when you're in the car ready to go somewhere and you're all dressed up, cleaned up. Oh, man, the cows are out. Something happened. A branch fell down, shorted out the fencer. And the reason it's a panic, because if the cows wander on the road, either the cows or somebody could get killed, you know, hitting a vehicle, and or they could trample the crops, which is really bad if it's a neighbor's crop. Having there, I didn't put it in my notes, but I'm remembering many years ago, I worked in Iowa for Land O'Lakes, and I'm zipping along one morning in my car, and there was a car ahead of me. It was a Toyota. In 1974, there weren't a lot of Toyotas around at that time as there are today. Small car. And the unfortunate fellow in the Toyota hit a 600-pound boar pig early in the morning. And the frame of the car became apart from the body of the car, and the frame kept on going, and the body of the car sat in the road with the hog. A very exciting day. Don't like those things. But, I mean, if something gets out, there's risk that can happen. But most cows will fear the electric fence. But then, you know, there's always one that will always test to see if the circuit is live. Well, Oklahoma cowboy Will Rogers was an astute observer of human behavior. And and he noted that some people just insist on learning everything the hard way, meaning they have to have the bad experience. And these are the same people, because they don't read about self-improvement, they won't learn by the successes or failures of others. We turn to Proverbs 15:22. You see, by listening to a counselor, people can gain the knowledge and wisdom, because the counselor often aggregates or collects and distills the knowledge and wisdom by reading and then observing others. And thus, by seeking counsel, a person can often benefit from the experiences of many people, even just talking to one counselor. In Proverbs 15:22, without counsel, plans go awry, but in the multitude of counselors, they're established. What that means is if you've got a plan, but you didn't get any advice as to the wisdom of that plan or what could go wrong, we're told right here in Proverbs, it can go awry. The things can get messed up. but so if you have counselors, and then notice it says a multitude of counselors, meaning multiple counselors here, which means they're gathering wisdom from a number of people that they have talked to and advised. And so the idea here is that we seek counselors to get advice to make sure that our thoughts and ideas will turn out the way we want them to. And if we don't seek counsel, then we've made a conscious decision to learn everything the hard way. Just like the cow that touches the electric fence with her nose just to see if that wire is hot. And when we share some of our concerns with our counselors, the counselors bear some of the burdens. A counselor must learn to deal with all of those burdens placed upon him or her from anyone who might ask him for help. Well, as part of the university counseling course, the professor required all students to write a paper about personal wellness. He explained that a counselor can't help other people unless the counselor was keenly aware of what it takes for the counselor to be healthy. And so the professor said, if you're going to take on the stresses of everyone else's life, it's going to take a toll on your own life. So you've got to be able to effectively help other people. You got to put your own life in order. Makes sense to me. I presume it makes sense to everyone else that we can't help others unless we first take care of ourselves. So the professor said, therefore, we must look in the mirror every morning and look to see ourselves as we really are, warts and all. Can't deceive yourself, because it's going to come out in the wash, as they say. And of course, this can be very uncomfortable when we look inwardly at ourselves. It's always easier to look at someone else and point out their faults. So easy to see that by comparison. But as church members, we know we are expected to examine ourselves regularly as we seek to become better persons. Let's turn to Revelation 5 and verse 10. In Revelation 5 and verse 10, and in a sense, we are all to become counselors. We're ready to help others, to bear one another's burdens. Indeed, the Feast of Tabernacles that we have experienced is preparing to help a whole world, a whole world. And because in Revelation 5:10, we're told that we're going to inherit a kingdom. And in that kingdom, we will be priests to God, meaning another interpretation is we will be counselors. and it says rain on earth. Our job will be here to be able to help other people. Well, what does a kingdom of priests do? In Galatians 6 and verse 2, and in Galatians 6 is verse 2, a priest, especially a counselor, one of those that has a sign for that, they bear one another's burdens. And in Galatians 6, 2, bear one another's burdens, so fulfill the law of Christ. Well, what is that law of Christ? If we're supposed to do that and bear others' burdens, in John 15, 17, we know the direct words of Jesus Christ in John 15, 17. These things I command you, that you love one another. So we're going to bear their burdens. We're going to show that by loving one another. And for that purpose, we have to remain strong. We have to build ourselves up, both physically and spiritually. If we turn to Romans 15, verse 1, in Romans 15, verse 1, it tells us what our priorities need to be in order to be able to help others. In Romans 15, and verse 1, we then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not just to please ourselves. We can be strong and then say, what's it to you? So what? Move along. Nothing to see here. And take care of ourselves. Or we can help to bear the infirmities of the weak. Now, we recognize as Christians that God has lifted the burden of sin from us. It's just like when God helped the children of Israel come out of Egypt. We read in the Exodus, and Egypt being a type of sin in Exodus 6:6. I am the Lord, I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, I will rescue you from their bondage, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. So God was actively bringing the children out to relieve them of the burden of sin. We read the next verse, I will take you as my people, I will be your God, then you shall know that I am the Lord your God who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, meaning free from sin. That's a pretty big deal. That's a pretty big deal. Well, 23 years ago, an academic group of counselors, Meyer, Sweeney, and Whitney, came up with a concept they call the Wheel of Wellness Counseling for Wellness. It's a model for treatment planning. And the objective of this wellness model is to develop counselors and their clients to have more joy in their life. Well, we all want more joy in our life, and I really like joy. Sometimes we get it in different ways, but we want to be counselors, not just to enjoy joy for ourselves, but to be able to spread it to others. In Proverbs 12:20, we have an interesting verse about deceit is in the heart of those who devise evil. That's the first half of the verse. So deception has at its core evil, an attempt to deceive others. But the second half of the verse, but counselors of peace have joy. So if you're going to be in a position to help somebody else, you need to be in a joyful place yourself to be able to help others. And counselors of peace have joy. So a happy, well-adjusted counselor is more likely to be in a position to be able to help others. Well, this wellness model that these professionals drafted up in the year 2000, they have five major life tasks that they said we all face. Five things in our lives that we must be well grounded in. And it's interesting. Now, this is a secular group, and the first thing that they put down was spirituality. You got to get that right. And we hear that word tossed around all the time. Spirituality. Well, there's a universal desire around the world for understanding a greater power than oneself. And we find that there are religions around the world, Hinduism, Islam, Shintoism, Taoism, animism, voodoo, pantheism, Buddhism, and there are many more, including many who call themselves Christians, and I call it churchianity, that are striving to for some sense of something bigger than themselves. And so, and we all know because of where we live that there are people that are called mainstream Christians. They go to church for social reasons. They pursue a social gospel. They all seek connectedness to the universe in some way or another. Yet they don't follow the true God by doing what God says in order to lead to a happier life. In Psalm 14 and verse 1, I suspect we've all come across this verse somewhere along the way. Psalm 14 and verse 1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. Well, the result of the world's thinking, world's spiritual thinking, isn't good. We are fortunate. We have an opportunity to respond to the call of God to a better way of life. So the first point that they said is you got to get your spiritual lives in order, whatever that happens to be, whether you're a and of course they didn't list in their secular humanism, but that's also a religion. The second point they said that we have to put an order in our lives is something called self-direction. Well, they call this the manner in which an individual regulates, disciplines, and directs the self in daily activities and in the pursuit of long-range goals. The patterns of behavior and methods of adjustment to life that make up self-direction are sometimes referred to as positive personality traits that give one a stress-resistant personality. Well, that's an interesting quote. In other words, they're saying, build a self-directional attitude in your life so that you can be stress-resistant. I kind of like that idea of being stress-resistant. Well, the researchers then said in order to establish self-direction, meaning pointing out what you need to do to internalize that, they have about a dozen areas they said you need to put your lives in order in these 12 subpoints. And the first subpoint, I'm going to call it the letter A, is a sense of worth, self-worth. We're all valuable to our Creator God, but not everyone sees themselves as worth very much. Life, we know, is like a roller coaster, and sometimes when things go well, then we feel more valued. And sometimes we feel less worthy when things don't turn out as well as we had hoped. In Psalm 139, starting in verse 13, the psalmist is explaining his relationship to God. In Psalm 139, starting in verse 13, for you formed my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. If you know, babies are wrapped in a membrane that's filled with fluid, so they're shock resistant to a large degree. Verse 14, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. We're all made out of the elements of the earth, but God knew what he was doing when he created humans. And God has a plan for each of us, that we're all wonderfully made. In Jeremiah 29:11, we read about God's plans for us. For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not evil, to give you future and a hope. Each one of us has a future and a hope, and that includes peace. I don't know about you, but I really like peace. How many people like to go home or go to work or go to school? And it's strife and war everywhere you look. Talk to those people who were at the feast in Israel or Guatemala and how well they like the lack of peace. It's very unnerving, unsettling for them. But it's nice to have peace in our lives, and we're blessed to have that peace here, very fortunate that way. And it's easier to feel a future and a hope from that. And yet, despite that, some people do feel worthless. They don't realize their value or their destiny. If we look in Luke 12, in verses 6 and 7, Luke 12, verses 6 and 7, we give a little insight into what how valuable Jesus thought we were. And people thought they were also worthless in his time. In Luke 12 and verse 6, are not five sparrows sold for 2 copper coins? And not one of them is forgotten before God. But the very hairs on your head are numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are more valuable than many sparrows. So it's not like God forgot about you and, oh, you're the kid hidden in the closet and nobody knows something along the way. God knows us, remembers us. So this first subpoint A was a sense of self-worth. Subpoint B is a sense of control. You know, don't you think it's amazing that some people seem to have it all together? And you look at them, they can have an orderly life, and it's from which our observation, everything just seems to fall into the right place. And then you do a little more exploring, they make a to-do list, they prioritize the list, then they do something unusual. They actually do the stuff on the list. They get it started, and I'm a great starter. I'm less effective as a finisher, but I'm working on it. And they follow that list through to completion. And then they do something really odd that most people forget about after they've accomplished it. Then they go through and they self-analyze, see what they could do to do better next time. Now, sometimes it's pretty obvious what they need to do better next time, but being careful planners, they want to avoid potential troubles. In Proverbs 22, verse 3, and Proverbs 22, verse 3, I'm going to read in the New Living Translation. We have the importance of taking and having a sense of self-control, of control over your life. Proverbs 22:3, a prudent person foresees danger and takes precautions. The simpleton goes blindly on and suffers the consequences. Well, that's a horrible thought. Have you ever watched some terrible thing happen in slow motion? And you're going, oh no, oh no, oh no. Something bad's going to happen here and I can't stop it. I was on the farm in Minnesota and I just made a whole lot of big bales of hay. My uncle, this is about 20-some years ago, was helping out. He came out to help out, and he was driving a tractor and had a load of hay bales. And he was about 1/4 mile behind me, and I could see him on the big road going up a slight hill. And for whatever reason, the hay rack that had all these big round bales on it, there were 2 in a row, tandem, and the back hay rack, which he couldn't see, the tie downs that held the hay rack in place in the front came loose. So the hay rack was tilting up and the bales come rolling off the back. He can't see it because he's driving the truck. And I'm looking a ways away. I'm, no, no, stop. He just keeps right on driving. Not a thing I could do. He couldn't hear me. I couldn't see me. I could just see this all going and bloop, 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 off they go. Had no sense of control at that point. I didn't have any control over what was happening. He didn't have any over that. Now, you can be sure that I made sure that that thing that was re-anchored down so that this hay rack wouldn't flip up and it would never happen again. But sometimes we stumble when we're going forward and we know better. And we know that we should have avoided the stumbling blocks in front of us. But we didn't pay close regard and develop our sense of self-control. Letter C and subpoint C, realistic beliefs. You know, realistic beliefs. Some people are remarkably well attuned to reality. And you can't help but wonder where other people get their crazy ideas. And it's easy to look around the world and see how foolish and unrealistic certain practices are around the world throughout history. I'm just going to pull one example out, and I suspect there are millions of examples. But one example in the Central America in the 14 and 1500s was the Aztec Empire, and prior to that, the Mayan Empire. But the Aztecs sacrificed thousands of people in order to worship the pagan deities, agricultural gods, so that they could get good crops and so forth. Now, we know that when you kill 1,000 people, and cut their hearts out and throw them over off a pyramid, it's not going to help the crops grow. Okay, so I would say that's unrealistic, and yet that became their belief system, and we think of that as foolishness, and yet many people ignore thousands and even millions of babies sacrificed each year on the altar of secular humanism. We call it abortion. The concept of wholesale slaughter of innocent humans is a tragic satanic deception and violates a fundamental commandment of God in Exodus 20 and verse 13 about you shall not murder. So we see it as, we understand it, see it as foolish, as a satanic device. And yet, despite our understanding of the sixth commandment in Exodus 20:13, many people slip into the error of incrementally hurting themselves. It's not wholesale slaughter like Aztecs or not abortion, but they do little things every day that don't increase their personal health or wellness or the health and wellness of their families because they're unrealistic with them. And if we're unrealistic with ourselves, we hurt ourselves and we're less able to help other people. About 30 years ago, an author named Robert Ringer wrote several books. I've read three of them, I think. One of them was called Looking Out for Number One. He had the best definition I found for measuring whether a person is being realistic. And he said, simply ask this question. Are they achieving their objectives? Wow. Well, if I'm not achieving my objectives, maybe I'm not being realistic. About what? About my preparation, about my education, about who I'm surrounding myself with, about my own resources, and just a long list of things that we may not be realistic about. And so I thought, that question really gets right down to the heart of it. Am I achieving my objectives? And we go back to Proverbs 22, verse 3. A prudent person foresees danger and takes precautions. The simpleton goes blindly on and suffers the consequences. So we can say that we have objectives, but if we're not achieving them, then we may not be being realistic. We don't see the stumbling blocks in front of us or the preparations that's necessary. The fourth subpoint, the letter D, emotional awareness. The point D is emotional awareness. Now, I have to admit that sometimes I need help on this subject. I tend to be an analyst, and I might miss the emotional component. And sometimes other people are more acutely aware of how others may feel or how a message might be received. So I feel compelled to seek counsel as to whether or not I see the full picture, whether I'm emotionally aware. And I go to Luke 6 and verse 39. And I don't want to be guilty of what it says in Luke 6:39. When Jesus spoke a parable to them, can the blind lead the blind? Will they not both fall in the ditch? Ouch. So if I'm emotionally unaware, am I going to not just fall in the ditch myself, but lead others there? So I need some help, and we have to ask ourselves if we realize how what we say and what we do affects other people. So point D is emotional awareness. Point E is problem solving and creativity. So we have to analyze our capacity there. And this is a strength for some people, and it's a terrible weakness for other people. Some people love to complain for the sake of hearing themselves talk. It's as if they're addicted to complaining. Now, complaining isn't necessarily a bad thing, so long as it leads to a resolution and helps solve a problem. Now, we've read through the Bible, and we recall the history of the children of Israel, and they complained about this, and they complained about that. But a complaint is sometimes pointing out what is necessary to accomplish an objective. If we read in Exodus 16 and verse 12, we heard about a successful complaint. In Exodus 16 and verse 12, I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. God heard them. The complaint was a request that said, we have some needs that we'd like to have fulfilled. And God heard that. So just because it's a complaint doesn't mean it's wrong. The in the legal world, a complaint is a request for the court to direct action. Because if you don't make, if you don't ask, you don't get. You don't, the and I didn't put it in my notes, but there's the about the importunate widow who repeatedly asked. She had a, an official complaint in front of the judge and finally achieved her objective. Not because the judge wanted to, he just wearied of her. So being prepared in that sense, or not being afraid to be a problem solver and use your creativity to do so, can be helpful. I have one of my younger brothers worked as a, and I may have mentioned before, was a troubleshooter at the biggest 3M plant in the world. He was their chief troubleshooter. And he said everybody wanted to complain, but then they came to him and it would go on and on. And he would cut it all short by one question: what problem are we trying to solve? Oh, well, that took care of a lot of the complaining part. Let's focus on what it takes to solve the problem. And so he used that. That, of course, he was a bachelor, and it was 2,000 women, and they all pushed the button to complain. And then he finally figured out they just wanted to talk to him. so he had to narrow it down, the discussion. So we laugh about that. Me more than him. So the next one, subpoint letter F, is a sense of humor. The letter F is, how is our sense of humor? Now, the definition of humor, and I got this from Bruce Anderson, an elder in Minnesota, now deceased. But this definition I thought was excellent. He said, humor is the sudden condescension to the unexpected. What a surprise. You didn't expect that. And comedians like to use that all the time. You didn't expect that ending, and that becomes humorous. Now, God has a sense of humor, and I would recommend people check out the sermon by Victor Howe of San Diego. The question is then, how is our sense of humor? Well, my youngest brother explained to me his wife's family has a very little sense of humor. So I said, well, how do you deal with that? Because he's a comedian, literally a stand-up comedian in Los Angeles. You know, I mean, that's his world, is humor. And he said, well, in order to help them out, he has to explain the background of the joke or the story first before he can tell the joke, because otherwise it's going to be difficult. So I asked him, well, how far back do you have to go in order to explain the background of a joke before you can tell it? And he says, well, first I start with, and the earth cooled, and then I move forward from there. So having a good sense of humor contributes to our physical and mental health. There's an interesting website called theheartfoundation.org, and they go through what happens when you laugh, when you have that sense of humor. And they gave a list of the top five reasons that you should laugh every single day. One is increased blood flow. Your brain releases beta endorphins, which is releases the release of nitric oxide, and that, and then their big words, while it dilates the endothelium, the inner lining of your blood vessels, and so forth. Then it goes on to explain that it's a healthy thing for your heart to be able to laugh. And if you do much laughter, it'll count as cardio, just like having a heart workout, get your heart pumping. And then it strengthens your immune system. Laughing every day, that sounds like a good plan. And they call it NK, natural killer cells. Natural killer cells are a type of white blood cell that plays a major role in fighting off viruses and bacteria. So increased blood flow, the benefits of cardio, strengthening your immune system. And then laughing reduces stress. Cortisol and epinephrine are two of the hormones released when your body's exposed to stress. And if you have a lot of those hormones released, your long-term, it can lead to depression, anxiety, weight gain, increasing your risk of heart disease. But laughing reduces the stress hormones in your body, opens up the blood vessels, lowers blood pressure. And then, of course, the benefits are lasting. Laughter is spontaneous, so there's a lot of different types. Study shows that the effects of mirthful fasting can last 24 hours. And so your arteries can be relaxed and stress levels stay low. So we all have heard the cliche, laughter is the best medicine. I believe that was in Reader's Digest. I don't know if they still publish that or not in a joke session. And we probably shrugged it off, but you can now write yourself a prescription for watching a comedy on a video or listening to a podcast or sharing jokes with your friend on the phone or wherever. The English poet Lord Byron once said, always laugh when you can. It's cheap medicine. I can agree. So sense of humor is critical, having a personal sense of humor. Subpoint G, nutrition. And I'm going to point here both physical and spiritual nutrition. In John 6, starting in verse 32, this was after Jesus fed 5,000 people with a few loaves and fishes, performing a miracle. And we go through this explanation after feeding the 5,000. And in verse 32, he said, Moses didn't give you the bread from heaven. My Father gives you true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. In other words, it's the delivery of Jesus Christ that's really the spiritual bread that we need. In verse 35, Jesus said, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and believes in me shall never thirst. So it's an important part of our spiritual diet is to pursue what it takes to satisfy our spiritual needs, not just our physical dietary needs. And we all hear that everywhere we look is to do what we can diet-wise. But we must never overlook our spiritual diet, what we need to do. And of course, that's an exercise in learning more. As Will Rogers says, we can learn by reading about that when we read the Bible. Subpoint H is called exercise and self-improvement. Now this, and I turn to Hebrews 12 and verse 1. In Hebrews 12 and verse 1, really we're all running the race of life. Now that's rhetorical in the sense that we're all engaged at the same time in this answering the call of God in running the race of life. In Hebrews 12, verse 1, it calls us to lay aside every weight and every sin that so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. Each of us have challenges. And so there's a spiritual exercise that we must do. And those spiritual exercises, we have to equip ourselves for that and not just physical exercises. I'd mentioned earlier that in preparation for the feast in Eastern Europe, my wife and I would walk around the hayfield for a mile, doing that daily to get our bodies toned up so that when we got there, we wouldn't be all fatigued on the first day or two of the feast. And we did that for a while, and it worked. And I'm pleased that that worked. But it was also a metaphor for how well we can do that same thing in our spiritual lives. So subpoint H was exercise. Subpoint I, it's called self-care. Subpoint I is self-care. I'm going to turn to Matthew 23, starting in verse 25. You see, self-care involves personal hygiene, but it also involves spiritual hygiene. Now, I've taught thousands of students over the last 20 years, and sometimes they didn't have good personal hygiene, and you could tell they hadn't learned the habits of good hygiene, of regular bathing and use of deodorant and so forth. So they hadn't learned the physical care, self-care for themselves. But there's also spiritual self-care. Matthew 23, starting in verse 25, what did Jesus say about scribes and Pharisees? He said, woe to them! You cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but the inside are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Verse 26, blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may also be clean also. So Jesus is saying, you got to do both. You've got to take care of what everybody can see. in our behavior, how we take care of ourselves. But you got to take care of what's on the inside, your thoughts, how you approach life, how you approach others, to make your heart right. So this personal hygiene and spiritual hygiene for subpoint I is critical for self-care. Subpoint J is stress management. We've mentioned that a little bit before. Subpoint J is stress management. You see, it's not stress that hurts us, because in order for us to pick up something, to pick up a Bible, there has to be opposing stresses. I have to be able to do some stress and pick up that book. And the same thing with everything else, there's opposing stresses. The problem is distress, what hurts us. An abundance of stress, that's bad for us. So what mechanisms do we use to cope with stress and distress? Now, sleep is often a good tool to prevent physical distress, because a lot of times if you don't get enough sleep, it's hard to make good decisions. Oh, I found that one out on a trip when you're going eight time zones away. And then you come back and get slapped coming back. So sleep is an important tool to prevent distress. But you know what? Spiritual rest is also important. We are given the Sabbath. We're given the annual holy days. We're given an opportunity to pull away from our work, from our school, from our regular lives, and be able then to rest from the ordinary part of life, to come back with it. And that helps us prevent distress. Now, interestingly enough, if sleep is helping us prevent distress, so does activity. So we can manage stress and distress by walking. And my wife and I chose to walk a mile or more. So now it's not that big of an issue for us anymore. But if we want to read about that, we read the 23rd Psalm. And really, this is an activity of what the psalmist is saying here. And if we go through it, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. In other words, I won't be lacking things. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. But you notice it doesn't say just stay lying there. It says leads me beside still waters. Sheep like to drink from still water, not moving water. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness. Well, that's a path indicates somebody's going along that path. You have to travel for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Well, if you're going to walk through the valley of the shadow of death, again, we have more activity. It says, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And we've gone over this, and perhaps we should again. The rod and staff really is God's law. It's a guidance. Just like you're guiding sheep with a staff, God provides guidance for us through his law. Verse 5, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. In other words, the blessings are many, and other people can see it. Verse 6, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord. Does it say for a day, a week, a month? It says forever. So that's a destiny that we have here on activity for stress management, is to be active and be thankful for what God has given us. Subpoint K, and now this is interesting. Now this was written in the year 2000, this outline, by these secular humanist counselors. And they put subpoint K, they put gender identity down. And I thought, how could they know that 20-some years later this would be all the rage among secular humanists? I simply put down Deuteronomy 22:5, a woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God. Well, I wonder why God would inspire that to be written. But it seems that occurred thousands of years ago, and we could go back, male and female, he created him. And by the way, this sermon video could not be played in the country of Finland. You cannot quote the Bible on such verses without being prosecuted criminally. So that's how careful we have to be in some parts of the world, is to speak boldly, speak the truth, but learn how to do it in such a way that works. So I don't think anybody here has any issue with gender identity, or anybody listening to this at the webcast or later. But we've all been to boy-girl school. We know how to tell the difference. Subpoint L, it's the last one under self-care, is cultural identity. Now, we can all be pleased with our heritage and glean the best we can from our ancestors. And mine are from Northern Europe. And so when I travel there, I realize this is where my ancestors, a number of them, came from. When we read Acts 2, and it describes the day of Pentecost, Christians gathered from around the world and spoke many languages. They weren't disparaged because of that. They were there to keep the holy days of God, the on Pentecost. And so then accommodation was made so that they could understand the preaching of the apostles at that time. So that covers point two on self-care. The point three is work and leisure. If we're going to take care of ourselves, we have to ask a question. Are we doing the work that is satisfying to us? I had an employee many years ago that her sister was married to a dentist. And the dentists are very particular. Everything has to be extremely precise. So she would tell me, she said, oh, my sister said that as soon as he gets off work, her husband, the dentist, comes home, curls up in a fetal position until he has to get up the next morning, because he has to be perfect all the time, or people agonize over the over that, and he takes it all very personally. The work was not satisfying to him. He could never be perfect enough on that particular job. I don't know if he pursued that and he kept on going to be a dentist or not, but that wasn't satisfying. So is our work satisfying to us, what we do? Or do we have active leisure pursuits that tickle our fancies? Are there things that we really like to do? Now, when I was 40 years old, I was younger once, and I did the inherited aptitude test with the Johnson O'Connor Research Foundation, jocrf.org, and to examine the 19 inherited aptitudes that we all have to see which ones are strong and which ones are weak. And that's when I discovered that the reason that I'm not a song leader is because I'm at the 5th percentile on rhythm memory. And so I have a hard time trying to figure out exactly how to do that. So if you ever wondered that, that got spelled out as to why it was a trouble and why I'm a slow learner on the dance floor, and it took so many lessons to learn the basics. But it also identifies generally four or five of our strongest aptitudes. And I would encourage anyone to take that test if they can. You'll need to pony up about $750 and takes a couple days out of your life. And they're in big cities around the country. Or you can spend about $3 and buy a book and self-analyze if you want, called Be Yourself or Your Natural Gifts. But identifying what is satisfying, personally satisfying for us, is part of what makes us happy, parts of what makes us feel fulfilled, what's satisfied. Now, at the feast this year in Estonia, Eastern Europe, we had three piano players. They were all from the same family, three siblings, and they took turns. And they all were able to sit right up and be able to, young people, be able to play the piano, accompany the hymns. They had the requisite talent, the requisite aptitudes to be able to do a good job of it. If we read Matthew 25, and I'm not going to go through it, but it's about the parable of the talents. And it really is about investment. And we can use it, the term for money, or we can say the term for aptitudes. But it's really summed up, this whole parable of the talents is summed up in another verse in Luke 12, verse 48. And I'm going to pluck a statement out of that verse in Luke 12, verse 48. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. Well, how do you know what's required of you if you don't know what you've been given? So you really should do your best to identify what is the most satisfying to you, because then you will be able to contribute the most that you can. Now, we had three young men at the feast this year that they didn't know they could give sermonettes, but they know that now, because it was that the bar of expectation was raised for them, and they were able to rise to that expectation, because to them it was possible, it was given, and they were able to do it. So number three in self-analysis is work and leisure. Are we doing what is satisfying to us? And that requires our work within the church as well as without the church. The fourth point, a life task, is friendship. A life task is friendship. Many years ago, I moved to a church area, and I went to a church congregation that had about 400 people. You can get lost in 400 people. And I found myself lonely because I didn't have a close friend. And I prayed to God that he would deliver to me a friend, but I didn't see any on the horizon. And I involved myself in every activity I could in the church. I was involved at that time in Spokesman's Club. I volunteered for the moving crew to help people move. I went on every outing I could. I took my kids to youth activities, and so on and so forth. I developed acquaintances, but a few years went by and I was exasperated. I just didn't have someone who I could call a really close friend. And then one day it hit me. I developed a best friend and I didn't even realize it. The friendship simply grew a little bit by little bit over the previous years. In Proverbs 18:24, we know that a man who has friends must himself be friendly, but there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. So while a brother and others and brothers and sisters in Christ can be close, we have a common understanding, a best friend is really helpful in life, really critical. Take a look in James 2 and verse 23. In James 2 and verse 23, we read about somebody who was called a friend of God, and that was Abraham. In James 2, 23, and the scripture was fulfilled, which said, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. Now, let's sit back a moment, and can we imagine that it was written in a book someday that we were called a friend of God? Well, that's what we are if we keep the commandments of Jesus Christ. In John 15, 12, we read about those commandments in John 15, 12. Because if we're going to be a friend of God, and Abraham was accounted to him for righteousness, in John 15, 12, we read, this is my commandment. And here's what Jesus is saying, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love is no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I've called you friends, for all things I have heard from my Father I've made known to you. So if we keep the commandments reiterated by Jesus Christ, we too can be a friend of God. In Proverbs 16, verse 28. In Proverbs 16, 28, many of us have friends, and sometimes we lose friends. That's terribly uncomfortable. In Proverbs 16, 28, a perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends. What this means is somebody is coming between us and our friend, Jesus Christ. We can't let anybody come between us and God. Don't let a whisperer, don't let somebody else say something or do something that will get in between us. Don't let anyone rob us of our future. In Revelation 3:11, you know, there's going to come a time upon the return of Jesus Christ. And that time, as we read in Revelation 3:11, "Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast that which you have, that no man take your crown." Don't let somebody interrupt your life, take away your destiny, take away your potential. Hang on to it dearly. And a true friend will help you to do that. The fifth point, the life task, is love. The fifth life task is love. It's no secret, everybody needs love. And there are studies that show how a baby thrives when they're held closely. That skin-to-skin contact, when they're talked to, they're sung to, their needs are attended to, they feel love. Well, staying close to God is a prerequisite for staying close to each other. In Deuteronomy 7 and verse 9, "Know therefore that the Lord your God, He is God, and the faithful God, which keeps covenant and mercy with them that love Him and keep His commandments to 1,000 generations. That's a lot of generations. 1,000 generations. In other words, it's metaphorically forever. It's going to continue on. In 1 John 5:2, "By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep His commandments." So if we're going to be a friend and be close to one another, we need to love God, keep His commandments, and then that love will be manifest. It'll become obvious. And of course, we read the next verse in 1 John 5:3, "And His commandments are not grievous." It's not too heavy of a burden. In fact, it relieves us of burden. So how will people actually know if we love God and keep His commandments? Because what if nobody ever knows? How will they know? Well, there's a way to know. In John 13:35, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another." It says all men can know it. Now, will they or will they accept it? That's a choice they make. But it is our opportunity to show love one to another. So this wellness model that the secularists came up with in many ways matches the scriptures. And the first life task, they say, is spirituality. And I would sum it up by saying this: how much faith do you have in your faith? Or a lot to pick from. A lot of faiths around the world. So it's critical for us to be well grounded in our spirituality, to have faith in our faith. The second life task is self-direction. This is a huge struggling issue for all of us. All of us have that sense of self-direction, and we all want to do better. Because under this life task too, we have sense of worth, sense of control, realistic beliefs, emotional awareness, problem solving and creativity, sense of humor, good nutrition, exercise, self-care, meaning hygiene, stress management, gender identity, cultural identity. All under self-care is a life task. That's a lot right there. The life task number three is work and leisure. Are you happy with what you do, and how you are and what you're involved in? Life task number four is friendship. How good of a friend are we? Are we being a friend? Are we seeking a friend? Are we capable of being the best friend we can be? And life task number five, love. Do we love God, keep His commandments, and express that by loving others so that the whole world can see? Well, if we examine these five major life tasks and then the list of subtasks, and we look in the mirror and we rate ourselves as to how well we're doing in each question, then in each area, then the question becomes, well, what are you doing about it? Don't you hate it when you get to that point in the message? Because now it requires a certain amount of personal responsibility. How well are we in tune with God and ourselves? And this is where we can develop a plan. Now that we rated ourselves in each category, and you can go through and rate yourself in every category because there's room for improvement for all of us, we can decide what we want to do in each category to become a better person, as the Apostle Paul instructed us in Ephesians 4:22. In Ephesians 4 is really a lesson on being converted to Christianity. In Ephesians 4:22, put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to deceitful lusts, and be renewed by the spirit of your mind, that you put on the new man, meaning the new you, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. You see, that's the ultimate plan, to follow the commandments of God, to be renewed by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, to change from a former way of doing things and put on that new man, and our shield and armor that's spelled out also in Ephesians. And of course, the details are important. We should write down the details of our plan so that we can stick to it faithfully, whether it's day by day, week by week, month by month. So as we now begin this six-month period without any of God's holy days, annual holy days, and while we're flooded with Satan's pagan holidays, let's ask ourselves privately and in our hearts, what's our plan to be the best child of God that we can be?